Welcome to Data for What, the Development Gateway podcast. I'm your host, Vanessa Goaz, and in this series, we'll explore combating climate change with data. In each episode, we'll delve into the pressing issues shaping our world by examining the critical role of data and technology in understanding and addressing the urgent challenge of climate change. In this episode, we're looking at climate action efforts that prioritize contextually appropriate collaborations to create solutions mitigating the effects of climate change. For this conversation, I'm stepping back from hosting, and my colleague Charlene Migwe-Kagume is leading the conversation. Over to you, Charlene.
Thanks, Vanessa. So my name is Charlene Migwe. I am based in Nairobi, and I'm from Development Gateway. We're an IREX venture. And today we're joined by Leonida Mutuku, we call her Leo, who's at the Local Development Research Institute. And I'll hand it over to her to introduce herself.
Thanks, Charlene. Thanks, Vanessa, for having me on this podcast. I lead the AI practice at the Local Development Research Institute, as Charlene has mentioned. And maybe I'll just briefly give a brief overview of LGRI before we get started. So LGRI is an action-oriented think tank based in Nairobi, Kenya. And we support African countries in their efforts to end extreme poverty, hunger, and inequality using data and technology.
Thanks, Theo. And yeah, today's topic is pretty exciting. It's something that we've discussed in the past before, something we're both passionate about. And it's just thinking about context-specific, as Vanessa mentioned, climate action, and thinking about how it's essential to combat climate change in a way that protects and supports those individuals and communities most impacted by climate change. And LGRI, Leo and your team, you've been working for a while on an early warning system that adopts more of an AI tool. It's really targeted at farmers. So we're excited to dive deeper into the conversation and learn more about what you're doing. I think what excites me the most about the work that you're doing is it's really building something from the ground up, building it with communities. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your work at LGRI before we get into it and the role contextualization plays in it.
As I mentioned earlier, I lead our accountable and inclusive AI practice. And as part of this, we support the development of standards and norms for accountable and inclusive implementation of AI in the public sector. So a key focus area is really public sector adoption of AI. But as part of that, we also conduct research on AI innovations for development in our context in Africa, but also supporting the use of evidence-informed policy, specifically on how we can think about the enabling environment, human capital required, and domestic financing that governments can consider so that we support ethical adoption of AI. In terms of contextualization, we tend to call ourselves system orchestrators in the sense that we work with local communities and deploy technology within these communities, but also use that work to collect evidence that informs policy making. And so we advocate for better policies based on that evidence. So this means that we have to have a very practical approach to how we conduct our practice areas and work very closely with grassroots communities who tend to be the key beneficiaries of development priorities by government. As part of this, like even across Africa, we work with local researchers and governments. So we don't assume that we are the only experts in this space. And we work with them to ensure our research and implementation is very contextual and has a real chance of positive impact. So different researchers in the different countries we work with help us navigate the nuances and make thoughtful considerations for the inclusive solutions that meet the needs of each of these contexts that we're working with. Charlene, you mentioned about our AI early warning system, which we are building for smallholder agriculture here in Kenya. So for us, we've taken a very participatory approach and work very closely with those farmer communities to design the AI, collect data from these farms with farmers, and ensure that we include indigenous knowledge from the farmers as we are developing the AI. So we collect feedback from these farmers each season to maintain trust. And of course, as we progress along, I will share more about our methodology and our approach and how we use this data to contextualize the AI we're building.
The word that you've hammered it really well is practical approach and thinking through the nuances and working with local communities and, of course, the indigenous knowledge, which is interesting to see. Same to us at DG. We've seen, I would say, over the past 20 years, thinking through the implementations we've done with governments, with development partners, with even communities themselves. Context does play an important role in our work. The most frustrating part is we've seen this come up quite a bit in climate work and climate implementation that's been happening in the past few years, where we're seeing a lot of serious engagement that's needed with local communities. So I think we could dig a bit deeper into the big one, which is, I think, at the beginning of every project, which is trust and gathering data. There's a need for representative and inclusive data, particularly for platforms such as yourself to train early warning systems. In Kenya, we have key planting seasons, right? We have March and September. And that's it. If you give a farmer the wrong information during those seasons, they hit really hard for a number of months. So having and knowing the importance some of these information systems play a role in farmer livelihoods and ensuring that the data that feeds the systems are representative and inclusive. What are some of the lessons you've learned in how best to gather this data from local farmers and any other data producers?
Giving a little bit of background to this work we're doing, we've been, I would say, building and testing this early warning system for about 2 years now. And as you know, data collection exercises can be quite extractive in nature. So for us, we've had to figure out how to center trust in the process. And to build this AI, we are required to use data from satellite images, but also ground truth data from the farms that we monitor. Building trust begins with how we even collect the data. And each season, we work with a small group of champion farmers to help us monitor the farm. So we are not necessarily the ones on the ground collecting data, but working hand in hand with these farmers. And champion farmers, we tend to describe them as trusted members of communities. So these are local leaders in most cases and early adopters of technology. And I always have to remind people that technology is not so much just the use of smartphones or laptops or what have you, but even in the agriculture context, thinking about technology in the form of new seed varieties, which are, in this case, climate smart varieties that are drought resistant or early maturing to help them adapt to climate change. And then many of these champion farmers are also from our network. So as I mentioned earlier, we've been running LDRI for 10 years soon, and for 7 of those years have been working very closely with farmer communities. So picked these champion farmers from those networks where we've engaged with them repeatedly and built trust. But while we are moving into new locations, like counties we haven't worked in before, we work with the local government officers in charge of agriculture. So for example, in Kenya, these are called the ward agriculture officers who help us identify farmers that are leaders in their villages. And then these champion farmers now are onboarded to work with us. So they tend to mirror the demography of the farmers in the community. So in our case, they range in age from 18 years to 65 years. And both male and female. And because most smallholder farmers are female, also most of our champion farmers are female. One thing about context is that, you know, you want some households are run by male people or some farms are run by men. So at that point, they might be more comfortable engaging with their male counterparts. And the same applies for where the farms are run by women. And so for these farmers, we provide them with a smartphone, data bundles, and train them how to collect data, but most importantly, how to seek consent from farmers each week they visit the farm. So both the champion farmers and the farmers know that they can withdraw consent to participate at any time. And as we are doing the training, we also walk them through how the data they collect will be used to train the AI models. So you can imagine how hard of a task this is, trying to find in local language terms like what AI is. Like in Swahili, we've had to use a word like akili bandia, which direct translation would mean like a fake brain or an artificial brain, just to explain what AI is. And then the final thing is how we incentivize the farmers to participate. originally would give them some demo seeds that they could test out in their farms, especially of these climate smart varieties. But of late, based on listening to feedback from farmers, we actually do practical agronomy sessions where the farmers also learn how to better produce their crop without just waiting for the AI. So every so often we are deep in the farms, interacting with the farmers. So for us, technology building is not just the data collection and the model building, but also that continuous sustained engagement with the farmers.
It's exciting to see your multi-stakeholder approach where you're talking to both government and then more a representative set of farmers. And I've learned what AI is in Kiswahili for the first time. And thinking about the value to the farmers. I think I have just a follow-up question on that. In terms of the champion farmers, how do you ensure sustained engagement and trust with them beyond the duration of the project or during the project?
The first thing that we do, and I think is the least important, is that given that these farmers actually do have day jobs, which is farming, and they have to take time out of their day jobs to engage with us, we do pay them a fee for the time they take out of their day-to-day activities to help us collect data. We have a small contract with them and a nominal fee that we pay them just to appreciate them for the time they've taken out of their day-to-day. But no, beyond the data collection, because each season we do tend to work with different farmers, we've found that that sustained engagement through agronomy advisory and inviting them to attend hands-on sessions in what we run every so often called farmer field schools, which are now like just hands-on demos at local agriculture training centers in the counties. So farmers physically visit them and learn hands-on, like from planting to harvesting, what to expect with different varieties. So we find that sustained engagement on the from a practical standpoint is very helpful to keep them as champions for our work. But finally, we tend to have many opportunities with different partners who want to work with these farmers. And so we do send out these opportunities to the farmers themselves. They have been able to use some documentation from us to gain other employment, including as data collectors for sensors. So the benefit for them goes beyond just collecting data for this period of time to like a sustained network over time. And farmers regularly also have access now to the AI for free, given that they have contributed to building it. So we don't charge them to access the recommendations and the advisory coming out of it.
Oh, awesome. At Development Gateway, we've been thinking about how do we move from the extractive nature of a number of past and existing data initiatives to make sure that the value that's derived from this data initiatives also trickle down to the providers of the data. You've highlighted really well on how do you package value of the stakeholders who support the ecosystem in providing that data. Now, thinking more about co-designing, which has been a word since I started in this sector that has been used in a lot of our digital rollouts. At DG, we have the Custom Assessment Landscaping Methodology. In short, we call it CAM, where we carry out assessments to understand the full ecosystem that will allow for data digital platforms or initiatives to really have the most impact. So thinking about the different stakeholders, thinking about already existing platforms, thinking about capacity, infrastructure. And then we use those findings, of course, now to situate some of our initiatives that we've done in the past. But I think, LDRI, you have done quite a bit of co-designing work, and it'd be interesting to know, what do you think of co-design in practice in terms of building the ground up? And what are the best practices you've learned about co-design?
For us, what we have discovered is that co-design is not a checkbox exercise, and it even matters a lot to the success and failure of our data collection and the ultimate models that we build from this data we collect. For starters, before we collect data at the beginning of each planting season, we tend to have what we call the onboarding trainings. So beyond just teaching the farmers how to utilize our forms and our technology to collect data, to train the models, the other thing that we do is have a very open focus group discussion, if you may, where we get to understand like what have been their practices in the farms over the last few seasons, like what are they observing, are their challenges, how are they using technologies, do they have solutions similar to the ones we are trying to provide, which is offering just-in-time advisory for farmers as they are planting. And from there, we learn like, okay, here are the shortcomings, let's say with the messages that they're getting from the government, which tend to be very macro focused in terms of planting and agriculture, that different ecological zones have different microclimates. So that the kind of messaging they're getting is not useful. So I'll give the example of Kiambu County, which we work in. There's, you know, Upper Kiambu, Lower Kiambu. There are the rainier parts of Kiambu. There are the drier parts of Kiambu. So if you just say you can start planting on March 15th in Kiambu County, it takes away from that nuance. So understanding those challenges they have with current advisory is really important. Understanding their use of technology, understanding how they operate in the farms and what they are planting and what's going on in the community is really important for us. So that sometimes we find we go back to the drawing board and have to redesign the way we are going to collect data just to account for what we have learned from that onboarding session. Then the second thing that we do is that as part of data collection, as I mentioned, we really want to include indigenous knowledge in the design of the AI. So we ask farmers before they finish a form that from our farm to leave us a voice note if they'd like with their own observations on what is happening on their farms. So these voice notes tend to be in English, Kiswahili, or the local language. And we listen to every voice note that is left to us and label it for intent. So if the farmer is describing that they think that fall armyworm has invaded a specific farm, we will annotate it and write that this picture has this label based on a farmer's voice note. And of course, we'll compare that to what our agronomist is saying. And from this practice, we've learned that we are able to learn how farmers use local terms to describe some scientific phenomena, which has been really helpful because we don't just want to predict whether a crop is healthy or not, or whether there's a disease outbreak or a pest infestation, or the likelihood of a season of crop failure. We ask ourselves the question, okay, what next? So we have done these predictions. Our models are doing well. But the only way our AI is useful to farmers is if we provide the right advisory for those predictions. So most of the advisory that's there is on best agriculture practices from a national research agency for agriculture, CALRO. But these are not always fit for purpose. They are just more very standard and are in formal scientific lingo. But when farmers are engaging with us, they are asking us a specific question. So good agriculture practices or the standard agronomy advisory won't help that. They need something more personalized, more targeted. So just learning, picking out keywords and figuring out how to provide advisory in local language really has been the next level for us to co-design and use farmers' input to get the right messaging back to them.
Thanks, Leo. Yeah, I think that makes sense. You've touched an interesting point on fit for purpose, and we've seen AI really play an important role in ensuring that people get the right information when they need it from big pools of data sets. There are sometimes assumptions that farmers will not use certain social media platforms or don't have smartphones, etc. Are you seeing a conflicting reality on the ground? Are you seeing farmers are able to use platforms such as WhatsApp or social media platforms? Just trying to understand, when it's all said and done, what would be the output of using some of the models that you've developed for the farmer?
That's a really good question. Maybe just to, before I answer that, so right now what our AI can do is we can predict yield with reasonable accuracy, given the date of planting and the geo coordinates of a farm. we can predict whether there's a pest infestation or a disease outbreak, or whether the plant has a nutrition deficiency. And then the final thing we can do is also predict area under cultivation and whether our farm has one crop or it's intercropped. So, I mean, just at face value, those are just probabilities, and, you know, that would be the output of the model. So how this then translates into advisory is that for each, like if we have reasonable or sufficient probability to believe that a specific issue is happening in the farm, then a farmer needs to be provided with just-in-time information on what to do. So if we have identified that, for instance, there is halo blight on the beans that a farmer has planted, then the next thing will be to, like, how do you treat halo blight? And the how do you treat halo blight really is how we now the channel and method of delivery of this advisory to the farmers is the core of the work we are doing, because building models ultimately I see is just something, a small part of a bigger play. And so how we are thinking about this is in a number of ways. The first thing we did is we did a survey amongst the farmers in our community, the ones who are our champion farmers, but also the farmers whose farms we are monitoring. And we realized, surprisingly, that smartphone penetration is 50-50. So basically, we have about 50% of the farmers across the board with access to a smartphone and can use apps like WhatsApp. Then the other 50% tend to have what we call feature phones that just have the general messaging capabilities. And Charlene, you know this from local language, Mulika Mwizi. Ideally, mm-hmm. these are phones that don't have too much going on for them, just good for texting and calling. And so that was really important for us, because we were not sure we wanted to build for smartphones, but we wanted to build for feature phones. But then that comes the next question. Like, if I'm trying to tell you that you need to use 10% of pesticide with this active ingredient to mitigate a pest infestation, from an SMS, that just sounds really overwhelming and might not be the best use of space for farmers. So here we decided that actually most of our local languages are meant to be spoken. So we need to start building a small language model that can move the text that we'd like to give farmers to speech. So what farmers can listen to is either dial a USSD code and listen to advisory about a specific issue. And that's one. The other thing is, of course, it's very easy for smartphones, because farmers actually right now tend to ask us questions on WhatsApp and we respond directly. So WhatsApp is another delivery channel, and we've been able to automate that. So farmers send us texts on WhatsApp or pictures of what's happening, and then we respond immediately based on how the AI identifies that image. And then the third channel, and here is where we will never let go of some of these old school practices, is using the champion farmers as intermediaries. Champion farmers, most of them have smartphones. Farmers, we've learned over time, do not just engage with them as friends or as leaders. They actually go to them with agronomical questions, which the champion farmers forward to us. So using them as an intermediary, then we believe that they can pass on the advisory back to the farmer without the farmer themselves having to have a smartphone. That are the different ways we are intermediating. So the hardest part of this really is now building that language model that will enable a farmer to pick up their phone and listen to advisory from text to speech, because this needs us to collect language data. And so the agronomy sessions that we've been having with farmers, we've ask them for their consent to record that so that you can use that as a form of collecting agriculture-specific language data to build these models. And we're hoping to see how that looks like in future.
Yeah, and I think you've highlighted important points on the delivery. I think we could have the best models, but if it's not in a form that the farmers would like to have it in, and it's not as timely, particularly when you think about climate change and farmers, timely data is at the top of the needs of a farmer, right? a number of things that you've highlighted and thinking through delivery of some of this data, co-design. And it's something that more broadly at Development Gateway we've seen, because if you don't do co-designing, well, a lot of really good, well-built data or digital systems lie idle, don't really serve their purpose. But the challenge is, how do you make sure you give sufficient time for this? So I'll give you an example of, we have a project called Alive in Ethiopia that's been funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that's looking at interoperability and looking at already existing government systems. How do you ensure data is shared? And you know, interoperability is a big part of the digital public infrastructure discussion. Because Development Gateway works a lot with governments, we've seen having to bring different government departments, personalities together to really think through what are the data standards that will make this happen. That's a form of co-design, right? Like, how do you make sure the underlying infrastructure or the supporting factors are in place for the digital system to work? So co-design cuts across all of it. And I think you've brought up a good part of co-designing also the delivery of the work. Just to summarize what we've said, so we've discussed a lot. We've discussed ensuring that the solutions are fit for purpose. We've discussed around how do we create value and move from the extractive form of data initiatives to build trust and to build sustainable solutions that allow for consistent data governance. And we've also looked at like how you co-design some of the outputs to make sure that at the end of the day, you're not building models for the sake of it, but you have the end user in mind, which means you're fitting your systems into context. But to summarize that, what have you found works best, not just in this system, but overall?
I think that's really been good summary of the lessons like we are sharing here. And I realize that a lot of the conversation really has been how we are working with the farmer communities. But you remember I mentioned that part of the work we're doing, we're also doing it for policy action. So we do have research organizations, the government, and other value chain actors who need to benefit from the solution we do, because they are all supporters of smallholder agriculture. One of the things that I wanted to first like to wrap up that train of thought is that for us, we have seen that you need community, of course, buy-in into the solution. So I always like to provide this example of when you think about like opening a bank or a lending firm, it's very easy to give out money. Yeah, you just like identify someone, they want a loan, you give them cash. But the business really is in collecting repayments. Like that's where the hard work is. And so similarly for our use cases, it's really easy to build assumptions, collect data, build models, which for all intents and purposes, based on our expertise, we think is useful for communities. But uptake and deployment will need a very thoughtful approach, one that centers the farmers, but also these other value chain actors who support them. So for us, what we have seen is beyond like some of the things you had mentioned earlier, channel of delivery, is it in a language, a tool, and in a manner that works for the farmer, but also thinking more broadly about the ecosystem that supports the survival of this initiative. And for us, one of the things we have found that works well in other work that we are borrowing for our early warning system is building a community of practice around our work. So our work has been graciously funded by GIZ Fair Forward Program. And as part of that, of course, we do need to open source some of the work. And so given that data collection, data curation is a very extractive process, we want to be careful to ensure that the data we collect can be reused and that not all of us are going back to the same farmer to collect the same data to do our own different things. So for us to ensure that there's no duplication of efforts, we are packaging some of the data, of course, anonymized as open source data for other people to build upon that. So that's like really a contribution to the commons. But the other thing that we are thinking of doing is opening up our infrastructure in the sense that we have such diverse data on farmers. And based on this, we can create standardized farmer profiles that like, you know, capture different farmers with similarities and use this to help inform other people who are building for use cases in the agriculture sector. So I think creating these layers of digital public goods in the form of APIs or ways they can plug into our system openly, but also open sourcing some of the data we are collecting, I think is one of the ways that we create appetite for the data and interest around a community that can contribute. And in maybe in other contexts, if you're like a researcher from Uganda, if you follow the same process, then you know you also publish your data and we can work together that way. The other thing is, for us, policy institutions keep on insisting that they don't have access to the requisite data to make informed decisions for development of the agriculture sector. So we are also building a dashboard interface so that policy actors, including the government and international organizations that support farming communities, can tap into, but also other people who want to create new value for smallholder farmers, such as the private sector, banks, and other actors can utilize these platforms to better understand what smallholder farming communities need and tailor solutions to them. So I think that is how we are thinking of sustainability for this project. So it's not just farmer facing, but also creating value down the agriculture value chain through other intersections with different actors.
I think that's a really great way to end this podcast, because institutions such as LGRI, NDG, I think we are best placed to provide this digital public goods that can support the full ecosystem, particularly because we are donor-funded and our work is really to share learnings and some of this community of practice. You've mentioned first, your data and digital solutions are tailored to specific needs and always with the final person using the systems in mind, as you've said, in terms of the output. But recognizing, and this is something that we are trying to build out at Adigen, and recognizing digital development is at an inflection point where institutions can achieve more technology than ever before, but we have issues of trust that we've ever seen before in terms of misinformation, disinformation. And so how do we ensure as institutions be able to publish digital public goods and also particular public data that can be useful to the sector as a whole and be used by other institutions that are doing the same kind of work? We're excited to see the potential good from solutions such as ourselves that are developed with farmers, with end users.
Thank you so much, Shailene, for having me. It's also been a fantastic opportunity to learn more about DG's work in this space. I think there's so much synergy, especially when we think about climate actions and how to support local communities. So I really look forward to working together to actualize these projects, of course, sharing outputs, but also just, being in this circle of amazing people working in the development space. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, really enjoy our conversation.
Thank you for listening, and a special thanks to our guests. This episode was produced and edited by Annalisa Goodman. Our theme music was created by Mark Hatcher. Learn more about Development Gateway and IREX Venture on our website at developmentgateway.org or through our social media.